Case number 23-1173. Interstate Natural Gas Association of America, Petitioner versus Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration and United States Department of Transportation. Mr. Marotta for the petitioner, Mr. Springer for the respondents.
Good morning, Mr. Marotta. We'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Sean Marotta on behalf of the petitioner, INGAA. In the final rule at issue in this case, PHMSA finalized approximately 275 standards. INGAA supported and championed the adoption of approximately 270 of them. INGAA is not anti-safety. Rather, with respect to the five standards that are at issue in this case, PHMSA failed to follow the mandates of both the Safety Act and the Administrative Procedure Act. And for that reason, those standards should be vacated in part and they should be remanded. I know we are challenging five standards. I know we have several arguments as to each standard, so I want to try to give the court what we think is the easiest way through all five of them, and that is the final cost analysis that PHMSA made in the final rule. Because for each standard at issue, PHMSA either ignored the significant costs that we're putting on industry entirely, or they incorrectly and inaccurately assumed that there would be no costs because they were simply codifying existing industry practice. Take, for instance, the corrosive constituent standard.
Let me ask you a just housekeeping procedural question. If we agree with you on any of the, substantive cost benefit challenges, do we need to reach the kind of procedural challenges to the alleged failure to perform a complete preliminary regulatory impact assessment for that same standard?
I don't think so, Judge Wilkins, particularly because when presumably if PHMSA goes back and re-notices these rules, hopefully they would take the lessons that we put in our brief and give a full analysis. Now, of course, there would be a question on any subsequent petition for review, whether I did a sufficient preliminary analysis. But I do agree with you that if you agreed with us on the substantive cost benefit analysis, the point that I started out with, you can, and I think that's why that's the easiest way through the case, because you can just say they didn't do this cost benefit analysis the way they should have, vacate, remand, and then they can sort the rest of it out on remand if they choose to repromulgate these standards.
So you're saying we could avoid all of the procedural arguments, not just the challenges to the preliminary cost benefit.
That's right. So we also have two arguments with respect to logical outgrowth. And you could also avoid those, again, if you agreed with us on the substance of the cost-benefit analysis. And the problems on the cost-benefit analysis, as I pointed out, are either that PHMSA assumed it was codifying agency practice and did not explain when industry said, no, we don't do it that way. We swear we don't do it that way. You really need to take account of the additional obligations you're putting on us. Or they just didn't mention it at all because, and I think a lot of those sort of tie into the logical outgrowth, because the reason it wasn't in the preliminary is because it wasn't noticed, but also I think they didn't put some things in the final, even after changing them at GPAC and later points. So that tends to be the problem. So in corrosive gas, for instance, PHMSA assumed that there was monitoring that was taking place at every single entry point to a pipeline. But yet at the GPAC, JA 415, 449, 443, industry came out across the board and said, we do monitoring, yes, but we don't do monitoring at every single entry point. We instead have a more dynamic, a more graduated, a more nuanced approach to monitoring, which if you're going to make us monitor at every single entry point, those are costs you have to take account of. But yet in the final rule and in the final regulatory analysis, PHMSA doubled down and said, we are going to assume that there is monitoring at every entry
point. Can I ask you about the stress corrosion crack segment phrase? And you say that that has a different meaning than covered pipeline segment.
That's right.
And the agency says they mean the same thing.
What I'll say is this, Judge Walker, if you want to throw me in the briar patch of saying that they mean the same thing, and so don't worry about it, it's really only three excavations, throw me in that briar patch and we can lose on that basis. But I do hope you put in the opinion so that way, you know, if another administration comes along, they can be a stop from saying that, no, actually that means nine.
Okay.
I think that's our approach to that. I mean, we have, as we explain in our reply brief, why we think that, why are you using two different terms? Why didn't you go back if they mean the same thing? But if at the end of the day, if they're going to stick by the opinion that it means three and this court agrees it means three, then I think we're all kind of happy at the end of the day.
Can you explain why you think it means nine?
Sure. It means nine because the industry has always understood the term SCCDA covered segment to mean three excavations, and industry has always understood each SCCDA segment to contain multiple covered segments. So in other words, each what was previously called an SCCDA segment would have in it the more defined term covered pipeline segment, two or three. So if you say there have to be...
You're basing that just on industry understanding.
I mean, that is what industry practice was up to that time. And again, like, I don't want to fight too hard on this, Judge Pan. If it truly means the same thing that we always thought it meant, then we're sort of in agreement. I think the problem is that if we didn't challenge that and the court didn't rule on it, it's not that I don't trust my friends who sit over here, but of course, they're not always going to be the administration. And if they came along and said, actually, they mean different things, and actually, you have to do nine without a court opinion saying that, I think it's going to be a lot different for regulated entities. But I don't want to fight too hard on that.
No, I understand. But the basis of your argument is just industry understanding, because I don't really see...
It was a previously undefined term. That's correct. And partly what I think...
Where is the industry understanding factually in the record?
I think it comes from the comments. I don't have a JA page for you that on that, Judge Wilkins. It was, I think, just sort of an understanding about pipeline operators were doing it previously. Because, of course, one of the things this final rule did, and it did do with some respects, is it codified existing practice in the industry. The problem is for these standards that we're talking about, the other four standards, PHMSA actually went a fair bit beyond existing industry practice and didn't take full account of the costs it was imposing.
But I guess the bottom line is you are conceding that if the term means what PHMSA says in their brief that it means, then
there's really no fight between us anymore.
Challenges.
I think that's right, Judge Wilkins. Yes.
All right.
Sure.
Ask about this severability question on C9 versus
right,
all
sure.
C. And, you know, I think I understand your argument. I guess I have two questions. One is about why they're, let me just say it this way. How would you be hurt if all of C9 were vacated?
So if all of C were vacated, I think the problem would be that we would not have the ability to engage in this dent assessment any longer as a means to, you know, all of these are ways you are going to address a dent, and there's multiple ways you can do it. And one of it is through this dent reassessment process where you can go out and do an assessment, do an engineering analysis and say, okay, it's safe for now, and we're going to come back and revisit in a certain period of time. And that depends on the safety factor. So if you take away all of C, we don't have that process. Now, Judge Walker, I think sort of implicit in your question is, would I rather lose on this argument or would I rather lose all of C get vacated? I would rather all of C get vacated.
Okay, I guess I understand. That's helpful to know.
Yeah.
But on which is the right course for us, it seems possible that if C1 through 8 and 10 tell you what to do and C9 says when to do it, and then we take your proposal and just eliminate the mandate on when to do it,
right,
you won't ever be required to do it because you will have never been told when to do it. And that would render C1 through 8 and 10 a nullity.
I don't think it's a nullity, Judge Walker, because, you know, there are existing industry standards with respect to dent reassessment. PHMSA wasn't writing on a blank slate. So I think in the absence of C8, we continue to do it on things like a safety factor of 2, which is what the API standard was. So I don't, and also remember, it's that we'd have to do it with respect, if we're going to rely on that to carry out our requirement to address death. So we would still continue to carry that forward.
Why wouldn't you just, what I guess, if there were no C1 through 8 and 10, and you wanted to do an assessment, how would that assessment look different than it would look under C1 through 8 and 10?
Well, I think if we didn't have C, my understanding is that we wouldn't necessarily have we'd have to address the dent in a different manner rather than through a dent assessment. I think before the entire addressing of dents through this final rule, we would do dent assessments and we would do them essentially the way they're done now. We would just do them with a different safety factor.
Fair enough.
I think also an area of costs where PHMSA fell short was on HFERW, the high frequency wells, where PHMSA assumed that pipelines were in the field already looking at these things and said that there was a particular manual that required it this way. We came in and said, no, the manual doesn't say that. And they came back and said, yes, it does. And as I understand my friend's argument on brief, they say, well, now the manual doesn't matter anymore. But the manual matters quite a bit because that is the basis for which PHMSA said there were going to be no costs that come about this because you were doing it this way anyway. So again, much like the corrosive conditions, it's PHMSA assuming that it's codifying existing practice and then not reasonably explaining why it was disagreeing with industry when industry came forward and said, actually, practice isn't like that at all. And the problem at the end of the day is not so much because my friend focuses very much on the benefits of this rule. But PHMSA has to take full account of the costs as well. That's a general APA standard, but particularly a standard under the Safety Act, which requires explicitly a cost-benefit analysis, unless the court has further questions.
Thank you. We'll give you some time to rebuttal. Mr. Springer, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Brian Springer on behalf of the federal government. PHMSA issued the final rule in this case after extensive input from the public and from the Expert Advisory Committee. I understand that there are a number of provisions that are at issue, and I'm happy to take the court's questions and be sure that we can be helpful for the court's questions.
I think the very first thing you said about they issued the rule after, how did you phrase it?
I said extensive input, Your Honor.
Was that true for what they did in GPA Midstream?
Your Honor, in GPA Midstream, the problem that the court identified was that in sort of the preliminary rule and in the preliminary cost-benefit analysis, there was no discussion at all, or in the final rule as well, of, you know, specifically this application of this rule to an entire category of pipelines, namely gathering pipelines, and therefore that the public wasn't on notice that this was a change that PHMSA was contemplating.
Am I remembering right that this rule was finalized before GPA Midstream was published?
Your Honor, this rule was issued before the publication of GPA Midstream.
Would this rule have looked any different if you had had the benefit of the GPA Midstream opinion?
So, Your Honor, I don't want to speak to, you know, how the agency would change its practices in response to GPA Midstream. You know, I think here that this situation looks materially different than GPA Midstream because the agency did specifically explain to the public the changes that it was contemplating. There was a long back and forth process.
And I take it that, you know, you didn't literally write the rule personally, but you are their counsel. You're representing them, right? You're representing the agency. You work for DOJ and you're representing the agency. I have this.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm here on behalf of the agency. That's okay. Correct.
And so, if you were advising them after, let's imagine that this rule were a draft and then GPA Midstream came out. If you were advising them as their, would you say, oh, we've learned something from GPA Midstream and that new knowledge should inform this rule in X, Y, and Z way?
Your Honor, whether or not the agency in the future may, you know, be kind of more specific in certain instances, here the agency did exactly what GPA Midstream contemplated.
I know that's your brief, and I'll only ask one more time. I don't want to dwell any more than I already have, but I guess my kind of big picture question is, is there any reason to think the agency has learned anything from its defeat in GPA Midstream?
Your Honor, I think that the agency is making substantive changes. I think that this specific cost-benefit analysis that we have in this case looks materially different than the one that was at issue in GPA Midstream, in ways that GPA Midstream specifically described, that the agency here went through the process of explaining what the costs were as to these different provisions, and then did some quantification of the benefits on the other side, which this court said was not the case in GPA Midstream, and that is what informed the agency's ultimate decision to say that the benefits justified the costs in this particular case.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So you haven't asked for a remand without vacater if we agree with the other side. So if we do agree that the cost-benefit analyses and the final analysis were inadequate, it would be a full vacater?
Your Honor, we haven't specifically asked for a remand without vacater. I mean, but I don't think we would resist the idea of remand without vacater, at least as to some of the provisions, but we haven't specifically asked for that.
It's
relief.
A vacater.
That isn't the relief that we've asked for in our brief, Your Honor.
Just to be clear, follow up on Judge Pan's question, in GPA Midstream, we vacated the rule, but what we said was we were vacating only, you know, these specific standards that were a challenge. And we didn't try to go through and say that means, you know, section so-and-so is vacated, but not the rest of the rule. We said we left it to the agency to figure that out. I'm assuming when you say if there were vacature in this case, you would want us to do something similar here and not vacate everything that was promulgated in the rulemaking, right?
So I want to make a couple of clarifications. I think in general strokes, that's correct, Your Honor. The first thing I just want to make sure is clear is that in GPA Midstream, because the problem was that the rule applied to an entire set of facilities that weren't discussed, you know, in the court's view in the earlier cost-benefit analysis, the vacater was as to those facilities as the gathering line specifically. I think here, if the court thought that there was some problem, you know, the other side hasn't challenged that the relief that they're seeking is specific to the provisions that they've challenged. The one exception I just want to make sure is clear that I think has already been discussed this morning is that if the court has concerns in particular with the dent provision, the safety factor provision, that we would ask the court to vacate, you know, 712C in its entirety because the steps are one integrated process.
I think that question is, I find that question hard, and you might be right on it. It seems a little bit odd for us to vacate parts of this rule that have not been challenged in this case. And I'm not saying that there's an absolute strict standing, Article III standing obstacle to us doing it, but it does seem like severability doctrine is in something of a state of flux, and part of the reason for that is it's just something a little bit uncomfortable about a petitioner saying, I'm injured by C9 and I'm challenging C9, and a court saying, we will take a red pencil or whatever the right metaphor is, and we will just cross out all of C.
So, Your Honor, I think here the agency has identified practical problems that would result in it, you know, to the extent that the court thinks that there are problems with the safety factor piece. The agency believes that it needs to reconsider the entirety of these steps that it has asked people to follow. It may, you know, rejigger some of the steps. It may change exactly what needs to be done because, as Your Honor mentioned, the part that we're talking about is when to do something, but that's all premised on the idea of what has happened beforehand. And I would also just point this court to a recent severability decision of this court, which is called Board of County Commissioners of Weld County v. EPA. It's 72F4284. And at page 296, there's a specific discussion of severability of regulations that says if the agency believes, you know, that the sort of pieces need to rise and fall together, that that's a reason to vacate sort of, you know, all the pieces that operate as a collective.
This, right? I mean, does the opinion say whatever the agency believes is true, even if it's not true?
You know, I think it says that you know, parts can be severed unless the agency manifests an intent for the entire package to rise or fall together. But here, you know, as we've explained in our brief, the agency, you know, believes that.
Here you're saying you have manifested.
We have manifested that intent, and I think we've also explained why the agency here thinks that these pieces are interconnected and need to be considered as one package, particularly because, as our brief mentioned and as is true, there's sort of ongoing research in this area that the agency would need to look at in order to figure out, you know, exactly how it wants to calibrate this provision.
Do you disagree with the petitioner when the petitioner says the rest of C would not be a nullity absent CNA?
So, Your Honor, I
had a lot of nots in that question, so a lot of negatives.
Your Honor, it's a little confusing what C would be doing, you know, in the absence of knowing when pipeline operators are supposed to go back and look at the dents. And as I mentioned, the agency, you know, might sort of change some of the steps that precede the decision about when to look at it if it's using a different safety factor. So these things all operate together. And, you know, there'd be some practical problems of people pipeline operators doing this process and notifying the agency, and it's not clear kind of what the agency should be looking for in determining when, you know, these reassessments should be taking place.
I take that, and I think maybe if I'm reading between the lines of their brief a little bit, what they're worried about is if they win on C9, they might actually lose by winning, because if we vacate all C, C9 might get better, but the rest of C, you might decide to make it a lot worse. And that's probably something that doesn't matter to us and shouldn't affect us. But, you know, it's, on the other hand, it almost seems like you might impose a tax on them for their successful litigation. Is that something? I think that's something that we probably should not worry about. And I think you probably agree. So can you tell me why?
Sure. Yeah, I don't think that sort of consideration should enter into the balance here, because the agency is making decisions about what's safe and what needs to be done to make sure that these dents don't cause problems down the road, don't become so serious that, you know, in the meantime, there's some catastrophic event that happens. So the agency needs the ability to set exactly what the steps should be, and it may need to recalibrate those if there's some tweak in some piece of this.
Can't you do that even if we don't vacate all of C? You could just issue a notice of proposed rulemaking and change things.
Your Honor, I think the problem would be particularly the timing of how long it would take, you know, for that to come out, because the agency has these processes that it has to go through, including the advisory committee, as well as notice and comment. And as I mentioned before, there has been research that came out during the rulemaking, and there's research that came out after the rulemaking that the agency would need to take into consideration. I believe there's also continuing research that's going on. So the agency would you know, need the opportunity to reconsider what to do here in light of that entire universe of research.
So if we were just to vacate C9 and you went back to the drawing board on that, you couldn't also, unless we vacate the rest of C, reconsider anything else in C?
Your Honor, I think the main problem would be the timing of what would happen in the interim while those other provisions, you know, the other pieces of C are still in effect, because the agency has calibrated those provisions to what it did in C9 specifically.
So what would happen if we only vacate C9?
Your Honor, I think it's confusing to understand exactly what would happen, because that is the provision that tells you when to go, you know, do the same set of steps over again to make sure that the dent hasn't gotten any worse. So I think that's exactly what the practical problem is that points up why, to the extent that the court has, you know, thinks that there are concerns here, that's why the entirety of C should be, the agency should have the opportunity to reconsider as one collective and not have sort of just pieces of it in operation.
I'm just having some trouble understanding why it matters. If you could just try to make it more concrete for me.
Yeah, you're right. So what steps sort of 1 through 8 say is the steps that a pipeline operator needs to go through to look at a dent and assess how serious the dent is. And then C9 says that you do sort of an additional analysis and, you know, make a decision based on the safety factor of when you're going to reassess, and you notify the agency of what you're doing. And so it's unclear if people continue to notify the agency what the agency is actually looking for. It's unclear that they've done enough steps ahead of time to the extent that we don't know when they're supposed to actually do this reassessment, of how this is supposed to play out in practice, because the agency was trying to standardize the process.
Will it be the same whether we vacate it or not? Are you saying that if we vacate C9, people aren't going to do it, which is the same as vacating C? I'm just trying to understand, like, actually on the ground, what's going to change depending on this decision.
So, Your Honor, I think what is going to change on the ground, the one important point is that this operates as an exception to an immediate repair condition. So in general, dents that have metal loss or cracking need to be repaired immediately. There's some sort of more nuance there depending on how the dent is oriented. And what the C process allows pipeline operators to do is go look at individual dents and delay their response if the dent is not so serious that it needs to be repaired immediately. So without this provision, there would be sort of the more immediate repair would happen in the meantime, which is how this process started to begin with.
And without C9, what would happen? What if C remains in place, but C9 is gone?
Your Honor, I think it's unclear exactly what would happen because there wouldn't be a specific provision that tells industry, you know, pipeline operators when they have to go back and reassess the dents. And in the meantime, they'd be notifying the agency that they've done these assessments, but that there's sort of no backstop on understanding when they have to go back and look at them again. So I think that it would throw this process into disarray.
Seems like it would be in disarray either way.
I'm not sure that's true, Your Honor. I mean, I think that without the C process, we would return to sort of what we had before, which is having the pipeline operators immediately repair the dents that are covered by the provision instead of delaying their response to make those repairs.
I have what I think is a quick corrosive constituent question. Corrosive constituents are by themselves harmless. Is that correct?
Your Honor, it's correct that potentially corrosive constituents are, you know, some of them can be by themselves, but in general, they're not. As a general matter, it's correct that by themselves, they are not problematic. It's when they mix in with other things.
And what about water, like liquid water? Is that by itself harm? That is, let's keep them out the negatives. Liquid water is by itself not harmful. Right.
Your Honor, I don't know the answer specifically to that question. I think water is one of the elements that's kind of the most potentially harmful, especially when it gets added into a gas stream. It's more likely to cause corrosion. I don't know the specific answer of whether if you had just a pipeline that's only transporting water, if that would be enough. But the point of this provision is just to make sure that pipeline operators are being aware of what they're actually carrying and the makeup of it, because sometimes when you introduce some of these elements like water or carbon dioxide, it can cause a gas that wasn't corrosive to become corrosive.
That's helpful. I appreciate it.
If you have any final points you wanted to make, I know you were waylaid by questions. I will give you a minute or two to summarize or make those points.
Your Honor, I don't think I have anything else unless the court has questions. We would ask that the court deny the petition.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're out of time, Mr. Murata, but we'll give you 2 minutes. If you
thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. First, Judge Walker, I'd say you're exactly right about the timeline with respect to GPA Midstream. It makes sense that PHMSA in this case made many of the same mistakes it did in GPA Midstream because it didn't have GPA Midstream available to it when it finalized the rule in this case. That's not a flaw that PHMSA couldn't read the court's mind, but it does show why GPA Midstream warrants vacatur of these standards. Second, with respect to C9, C9 can be severed off because there are existing industry standards that tell you how long you take with respect to the safety factor. And I do think you're right, Judge Walker, that when, for instance, you look at the recent Affordable Care Act litigation, there's real concerns about essentially expanding the notion of what is going to be taken out of a statute or out of a rule just because there is one particular subpart of it. So I think that's troublesome. And I think you're also right, Judge Pan, that there is nothing that prevents PHMSA when it goes back after vacatur and says, you know what? If we're not going to be using safety factor 5 in the future, then we got to take a look at everything else too. When they reassess it, they can reassess all of it, and they can do that through their normal notice and comment rulemaking procedures. Finally, Judge Wilkins, with respect to SCCDA, the site is Joint Appendix 701, 702 with respect to the reconsideration petition. There is not a record with respect to what industry's understanding of SCCDA was because it goes to some of our notice problems with respect to it, because that was, in our view, sprung on us after the notice and comment process. We didn't have the chance to make a record. But as I've said to the court throughout, if the court just wants to say they say the same thing, we're fine with that result. Lastly, Judge Walker, we have the same understanding as our friends from PHMSA with respect to water. It's that water standing by itself is harmless. We do agree that when it's mixed with gas and can become corrosive, that's where the harm comes in, and operators can and do monitor for that aggressively. For instance, when there's so-called wet gas that enters the pipeline, that's what they're monitoring for. They do keep an eye out for that as part of their dynamic monitoring processes, unless the court has questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Take the case under advisement.